Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we have our first big hit of the year, a Minecraft movie, which debuted to a staggering $157 million domestic, $300 million or so worldwide. That more than doubled the projections from Warner Brothers and the other studios. It's another hit for Jack Black, who remains one of the closest things we have to a butts in seats movie star, at least when it comes to kids' movies. And for Jared Hess, the director of Napoleon Dynamite, who helped give this movie a sort of weirdo charm that might have been otherwise lacking from a studio, you know, IP play of this sort. I took my son to see it late afternoon, early evening Friday screening on Friday. We went to the Dolby Cinema at the AMC here in Dallas because all of the Draft House screenings were sold out in my neighborhood. Instantly knew this was going to be a big hit. Yes, the theater was packed, but, you know, sometimes theaters are busy on opening day. It wasn't just the number of people in the audience, though. It was like the real palpable buzz of excitement that this gaggle of 13 to 18 year olds brought to the venue. They were amped, folks. They were amped. They were yelling out phrases. They were yelling out, "I am Steve," and "chicken jockey" to each other, among other things. These would make more sense if you've seen the movie. You don't really need to. Here was the weirdest thing. A bunch of them were dressed up. I couldn't tell if this was like a Gentle Minions sort of thing. Remember that? The kids, the teens and the tweens, they threw on the suits and the shades to enjoy the Despicable Me movie. Or if they're, I think some of them may have been there as like a pre-prom or other fancy party dinner sort of event, right? There was a couple, a guy in a tux and a girl in a corsage, and they were taking a picture in front of the poster. I didn't want to ask. I didn't want to be the 42-year-old who went up to these teenagers and was like, "Hey, why are you kids dressed up?"
They were dressed up for the Minecraft movie.
I don't want to make them feel weird, but I was definitely taken by it. That energy continued into the screening, right? Kids were shouting lines from the trailers throughout the film. They were whooping and cheering every time literally anything in this movie happened. There were cheers and people were yelling. It was wild. I have not seen anything like this since Spider-Man No Way Home. It really was like going to the Rocky Horror Picture Show as a novice to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where like things are happening that I didn't understand. Like people were reacting to things I didn't understand.
Was there audience participation? Like, did anything weird happen to you?
No.
Rocky Horror?
No, not like that. All right, anyway, between the kids recording the screen while the anarchy unloosed around them and the overwhelming noise drowning out the dialogue from the screen, some folks are unhappy. Some folks are unhappy about what has been happening at these showings, and I get it. I empathize. I'm a stickler for movie theater etiquette, right? So I'm pretty sympathetic to the people who are annoyed by this, at least in theory. In a movie theater, you should behave yourself. It's a communal space. But also, like, it's a Minecraft movie. This isn't Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation.
It's not cinema.
It's not Oppenheimer or The Zone of Interest, right? You don't need to solemnly absorb the message coming from the screen. You're not missing out on key plot points because people are freaking out. Getting worked up about the behavior here is a little bit like getting worked up about people singing along with Taylor Swift songs at that concert movie she had a while back. I get it. I sympathize. If I was like really into Minecraft and was there to really enjoy this movie, I probably would have been annoyed. But also, like, I wasn't, so I didn't care that much. Let the kids have their fun. I say, Peter, a Minecraft movie creating the sort of theatrical event that will convince the next generation to come to the movies. Is that what's going on? Or is it the sort of thing that's just going to scare away audience who already attend movies?
Look, I don't know about your screening of Zone of Interest, but I'll tell you, when I saw it, the teenagers were just, oh, wait, no,
we're not making jokes about the kids dressing up like Frau Haas. We're not doing that.
Sonny started this one. All right. I have somewhat mixed feelings about this, but they're mixed in the direction of the teenagers. So on the one hand, you shouldn't, like, as a general rule, behave yourself in public spaces. Don't bother other people at a screening. Like, that's, that should be your guideline. On the other hand, as you said, it's a Minecraft movie. It's a movie that's supposed to be fun. It's a movie that's based on a participatory, like, big group video game that everybody, not everybody, that many of the viewers are going to already have, like, treated as a shared experience, one in which they are communicating with each other, in which they're talking to each other, in which there are a lot of in-jokes. And developing that sort of thing can be great fun at the movies and can be a great way to market your movie and bring people out. And so, you know, you said that you hadn't seen people like this since Spider-Man No Way Home. Actually, when Spider-Man No Way Home came out, that was like the first real, like, pretty big movie, not pretty big, the first, like, genuinely big hit after the pandemic. We'd already had the first Dune film and some other movies, like, and I think the three of us have been going to movies for most of, for the better part, I should say, of 2021. I think we started around April, May of that year.
Yeah,
right?
Didn't we start with Nobody?
Yeah, April 2021 was Nobody was the first movie I'd seen outside of Tenet in a movie theater in 13, 14 months. And so, but December, right? Like, there were still not that many people at the screening that I saw, but this did remind me more actually of Barbenheimer, and Barbie in particular, where, no, people were not necessarily dressing up to go see Oppenheimer. And it wasn't a big shouty participatory thing. I actually saw a 70 millimeter press screening, but there were people going up and down, like, there's a path, a walkable path to get to my Alamo Drafthouse here. There are people going, walking up and down the whole first week that that movie was open, like, clearly going to see the Barbie movie. They were in costume, like, and these were even adults, right? I mean, there's people in their 20s. And I thought that was great. Like, it's just nice to see people, like, enjoying the fun and participatory experience of the movie. And so, to some extent, this is context dependent. And if you go into the Minecraft movie on opening weekend and you expect, like, a really solemn and serious zone of interest style, that's actually how it was, its zone of interest. It was very quiet and it was very solemn. If you expect that sort of way of viewing it, then I think that's a mistake. And, like, this is a little bit of a fine line to walk here, because in some sense, if it's organized, you know, sort of centrally, it becomes less fun. The Alamo, we reference this all the time, but it's like they think a lot about this sort of thing. The Alamo near my house actually has screenings that are, like, forget exactly what their term for them
movie
is.
Movie parties.
Like, yeah. Movie parties, where you are encouraged, not just, like, in the advertisement, but up front, often by an MC who is brought in to, like, scream, throw things. They will even give you props and noisemakers. I saw a screening of Jaws that was a movie party, I don't know, a year or two ago, in which for the shark exploding at the end, they gave everybody these, like, indoor safe firecrackers that created, like, a big pop and just a tiny hint of a smell of smoke so that you could smell the shark smoking. As it was blowing up, it was really, really fun. Ben Dreyfuss's dad was great. He killed that shark. He killed that mean old shark, right? But at the same time, like, you don't necessarily want theaters to say, okay, this is the fun for teenagers screening in a sort of, you know, and like announce it. Like, a part of the fun of it is that it is not organized by the adults and the authority figures when you are, you know, when you are 18. And I did stuff like this when I was much younger. I mean, there are photos on the internet of me dressed as Han Solo in a Jedi robe, carrying a lightsaber at the premiere.
Just as Han Solo?
Han Solo. Sorry, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Wow.
As dressed as Obi-Wan Kenobi. Man. My Star Wars. Oh, man.
Your cred is gone.
I'm found out. I don't even know the difference. It's one of those guys. The same, right?
Are we even podcast co-hosts? Like, who are you? Have you been taken over by someone else?
Oh, guys, I'm a little bit tired. I dressed up along with a bunch of other teenagers my senior year in high school to go see The Phantom Menace. There was a photo of me taken that made the front page of the local newspaper. It's been posted on the internet. You can Google it if you're really desperate to see what I looked like at 17 years old dressed in a Star Wars costume. And it wasn't like someone gave us permission. It was like, no, we're going to the midnight screening and this is what we're going to do. You know, and even there were even times when I will share, like, I don't know whether I like, is this shameful on my part or is it, like, really funny? When I was a little older than that, in my early 20s, I would take my brother, who is 5 or 6 years younger than me, and his dumbass friends. And I think they would all agree, like today, we could all refer back to them. They were dumbass teenage boys. And we'd go see movies like Aliens versus Predator or Freddy versus Jason. And they would kind of yell at the screen because this is freaking Aliens versus Predator and Freddy versus Jason. And those were dumb movies that are designed to be yelled at. And I think there were some times where, in fact, some of the other people in the theater got annoyed with us. And I, as the sort of quasi adult figure there, I just thought this was hilarious that the 16 year olds I was accompanying as a 21 or 22 year old were just absolutely acting up kind of obnoxiously. And I don't like what's some amount of, I guess the thing that I'm trying to say is, some amount of like this shows enthusiasm for the social part of the theatrical experience in a way that I basically approve of. This, I think, demonstrates that like if you can make movies social events, that is going to be good for the movies and for movie going. And to some degree or another, that fun, especially when you are 17, is going to rely on a little bit of tension about what the exact rules are and whether or not you are breaking them. And you don't want to just be completely obnoxious about it, but you also don't want to sort of try and say, well, this is our safe zone for being loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Alyssa, I mean, I think it's important to draw a distinction here between there is bad behavior in movie theaters that is born of either just like rudeness or boredom, right? Like somebody,
yeah, sort of
if somebody's sitting there,
disengagement. Yeah.
Somebody's sitting there scrolling through TikTok on their phone or sending
or like
text
a sort
messages.
Of active disregard for other people in the audience, which is something that I've experienced a lot of the like Landmark Bethesda Row, which has just, I find like an astonishingly rude audience, just a lot of talking. But yeah, something that is spontaneous and fun. And that I think critically, like, if you're sort of more than half the audience is like, then the norm shifts and like, you're totally in the clear.
It's a democracy.
Yes.
Not really.
I mean, I don't have a ton to add to what Peter said, except for the fact that I think another reason that it's specifically good in this case is that it's a demonstration that even kids who are growing up at a moment when sort of social media and video games are the ascendant, in some cases, dominant form of entertainment, it's a sign that they still crave the validation of the movies, right? That like there's something that it's still a big deal to see your other form of media kind of recognized by Hollywood and translated into a big screen extravaganza. And I think that's something that's going to be important and interesting as video games become a more significant form of entertainment. And if Hollywood finds a way to do that well and to inculcate the idea that movie going is fun, that's a way for the industry to maintain its relevance and hopefully be a bridge to other kinds of movie-going experiences. Also, Peter, I found this picture of you in your Obi-Wan Kenobi outfit. And wow, you look like you're like 7 years old and also your lightsaber is the wrong color. Only Sith have red lightsabers.
The lightsaber was brought to me for if it wasn't my lightsaber.
Well, it's still the wrong color and you should be embarrassed is all I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm embarrassed for so many reasons, but also not at all embarrassed.
Okay. All right. I'll try and remember to include a link to this in the email so everybody can see what Peter looked like. It was silly. He looked silly. It's fine. Being silly is fine. I'll take the devil's advocate side of this thing since somebody's got to argue it. One thing that jumps out is the urge to turn all of this stuff into content, right? So, like, it's not just that people are excited at the movie theater and having fun and everybody's having it. There is the element of we're going to tape ourselves having fun and then we're going to put that on the internet. And again, like you say, like, okay, well, it's the Minecraft movie and that's already kind of an online social multi-person experience. I do find it slightly off-putting in the sense that I would, you know, I think people should live in the moment. Like, life shouldn't be a series of things that you try to turn into engagement elsewhere.
Yes,
but my Sunny, counterpoint, we are taping our fun right now, and we are about to put it on the internet.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but that's a
you
job.
You lost that battle. You're being, you lost that battle. It's over. Society has fallen.
All right, fair enough. All right.
It's just like the White House in that Gerard Butler movie.
Boy.
All right. What about the other one, the White House down? All right. So what do we think? Is Minecraft pandemonium a controversy or a non-troversy? Alyssa?
It's a non-troversy, and in fact, it's an affirmative social good.
Peter?
Non-troversy.
It's a non-troversy, though, you know, it would be kind of funny if they did, like, the inverse old person screenings. Like, you know how, like, you have, like, the special sing-along screenings for Wicked or whatever? Instead of that, we'll have, like, a sit-in-silence screening for Minecraft. Everybody can just sit there and absorb the auteurist message of Jared Hess.
So the one person in America who wants to sit there and absorb the auteurist message can go to the screening.
I'm gonna go to that, and I'm gonna shush everyone in the audience anytime they try and get a loud yelling chicken jockey and the such. It was one of the craziest things I've ever been at.
Before we move on, one quick question: how were they quoting things on opening weekend? Had they already all seen the movie several times, or is this all stuff directly lifted from the game?
No, they were. My sense is that they were repeating lines from the trailers, which have been playing in, like, you know, kind of cut up form on TikTok constantly. So, like, when Jack Black shouts chicken jockey, when there's a character that drops onto a little Minecraft chicken and starts riding it around, he shouts chicken jockey in the trailer. They were shouting that, like, before the movie started. I don't know what to tell you. And this is the other kind of weird thing about it, is that it is not entirely organic. The folks at Warner Brothers and Legendary did an amazing job marketing this movie, is my point. Like, there were people who were so excited from the trailer that they were shouting lines from the trailer during the movie, which, again, is just unreal to me. I've never seen anything like it.
So this was basically like what Catherine Hahn was doing in with the Kool-Aid Man, doing the dance from TikTok.
Speaking of...
We're going to explain this, folks.
Get to that in a second. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. We're going to be paying tribute to the great Val Kilmer. He died last week. These things tape so far in advance that surprise deaths, it's hard to do, bang out a quick bonus episode. But we're going to do one for Val Kilmer. I think it's worth the wait. It's worth the wait, because he was one of the greats, and I am excited to talk about him with Peter and Alyssa. And now on to the main event, The Studio, which is a new series streaming now on Apple TV Plus. Seth Rogen, who also co-created the show with his longtime creative partner, Evan Goldberg, stars as Matt Remick, the new head of Legendary Continental Studios, not a real studio, fake studio. He loves showbiz. He got into the business to make great movies like Rosemary's Baby and The Godfather, and he'll do anything to make that happen, at least until he's confronted with the reality of running a movie studio these days. And the reality is that they don't make The Godfather anymore. They make the Kool-Aid movie. Sidebar, the elevator pitch for Minecraft is like, it's a movie based on Minecraft directed by the guy who made Napoleon Dynamite. And that is absolutely the sort of thing that Remick would be down for. He would be like, yes, it's an auteurist driven idea of Kool-Aid Man. We could do that. Sure. Why not? Anyway, back to my point. The Studio is pretty straightforward Hollywood satire, right? It's very much in line with The Player, which is a movie that is name-checked in The Studio via the name of the new owner of Continental Studios, Griffin Mill, who's played by Bryan Cranston. There are lots of big cameos from big Hollywood names, right? Martin Scorsese is a big part in the first episode. Charlize Theron shows up toward the end of it. There's in the third episode, it's all about Ron Howard and Anthony Mackie trying to resist taking a note from Remick and his team of suits. And folks are going to find, you know, some less familiar faces. If you're a close watcher of Hollywood, you'll recognize Sarah Polley in the second episode, Peter Berg in the first. A number of the characters are clearly based on real life people, right? Such as displaced studio chief Patty Lee, who is played by Catherine O'Hara, who is very, very obviously modeled on Sony head Amy Pascal. But the show feels less like The Player, even with obvious homages like the single take second episode and the Griffin Mill name check. It's more like Birdman by way of Curb Your Enthusiasm, right? This is a cringe comedy with cinematic verve, right? It's the awkwardness is heightened throughout by the handheld long take shots, which kind of obsessively and aggressively follow Remick around as he stalks from office to office or through movie sets or around parties. And that tension ratchets up to like 11, thanks to the driving jazz score. It's just all snare drums and cymbals and hi-hats as Remick kind of ham-fistedly destroys the art form he loves so dearly. It's a tense show is what I'm saying. It's very, very tense. So tense that my wife bailed after episode one. She's like, I don't need this in my life. You can keep watching if you want. And I did want to keep watching because I am a fan of Birdman and Curb Your Enthusiasm. I myself enjoy the panic attack affectation and the cringe inducing antics of Matt and his team. Your mileage may vary. Alyssa, were you able to make it through all the episodes so far?
No. I did not like this. You told me I had to watch two episodes of this. And if you told me I had to watch three episodes of this, I would have refused to do it. I literally spent most of the second episode on my phone because I could not deal with how unpleasant it made me feel. Let me be clear. I think the studio is extremely well made and acted, and it is so not for me. I don't like cringe comedy just sort of as a general rule. I especially don't like watching someone sort of get their dream and then find out both that they're really bad at it and that they're totally willing to compromise like all of their ideals and everything. It's both not funny to me because I feel so terrible for Matt and everyone who's sort of damaged by his stupidity and cowardice. And I also feel like the show weirdly isn't mean enough in the sense that, you know, Matt is sort of a fundamentally likable figure who has kind of bungled into this situation. And I have a really hard time believing that anyone who has become that prominent an executive in Hollywood would get to the level of running a studio and just not know what he's in for. I know that this is sort of a weird hobby horse of mine, but I maintain that Entourage is just pretty hard to beat as a great send-up of Hollywood, in part because it doesn't pretend that anybody's real naive, right? It's, you know, you kind of have Eric as the audience surrogate who, you know, sort of believes that Vince should be true to his art, blah, 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 blah. But he gets disabused pretty quickly, right? And I kind of think the studio lets Matt off the hook in a way that is maybe inevitable given the fact that Seth Rogen is both playing him and writing him. And I really like Seth Rogen. I actually quite liked American Pickle, which I think is like one of the most Jewish movies ever made. Incredibly amusing. Really liked it. But I just think that this movie's vision of Hollywood is kind of a cop-out, right? It's like Matt needs to be a more compromised figure for the show's satire to land. Am I wrong about that?
So you're saying he's too hopeful going into it.
Yeah. And too sort of uncompromised as a person, right? I mean, he's sort of, you know, maybe he's compromised as a person. We don't know that much about sort of his backstory or like his work in the past. But his naivete kind of makes him feel dumb, but also makes him an innocent, right? Like he is dumb and he keeps screwing up, but he's not sort of quite compromised in the way you might expect. Like he makes compromises. It's not even compromises. He behaves in ways that are like cowardly and cruel. You know, see his sort of briefly embracing Martin Scorsese's Jonestown movie as a way to like make an artistic Kool-Aid movie and then screwing over Martin Scorsese. But he is not, he doesn't have sort of perspective on the industry, and
he doesn't have a backstory, not nearly enough of one. And this is the thing, there's barely anything that we know about him. Like, so like, I think you're very right about this, Alyssa, yeah. Even though I think I like the show more than you, but think about, we learn almost nothing about him except he says he has no life other than movies. He's been doing this for about 20 years. And at some point in his career, he tells the Bryan Cranston character he bought a script or a property that did produce $1 billion over a couple of films for the studio. We don't know if I don't think it was a superhero film, but yeah, we don't really know anything other than that it was like a multi-film franchise. And like, this is the thing, is a guy like this would have much more experience and kind of like detailed thoughts, even if they were wrong, even if they were stupid, about the movie making, about like actually being on set, about what it takes, about the movie making process, the role of the producer, the role of the director, like how these things work. And like we get, okay, we get one other fact about him in episode three, which is that he made a bad suggestion to Ron Howard about A Beautiful Mind when he was very young. But this is, again, the sort of like, we don't actually see that this is someone who has deep, like who really has 22 years of experience as a producer in the film environment.
And why would you root for him, right? Like, why is he either a credible sort of standard bearer for the idea that artistically ambitious movies can be popular? Or, you know, why is he a sort of savvy sort of shark who you, there's no reason to root for him or to root for his vision of Hollywood?
Well, you root for him because he is the audience surrogate, right? Like he is like the conception of this character is essentially, you think it's so easy to run Hollywood. You've got so many great ideas on how to make these artistic movies that would also be commercial successes. Well, what would happen if you were put in that role? Okay. And that's what's kind of interesting. Yeah. In Entourage, you mentioned E, you mentioned Eric.
Yeah.
He is the audience surrogate, but he's not the one who actually has any power. It would be like making Ari the audience surrogate.
Well, and Ari
making
sort of,
Vincent.
Yeah. And he eventually Ari eventually becomes the main character. But I mean, there's this very interesting moment at some point in Entourage when Vince asks Ari if he's a good actor. And Vince keeps and Ari keeps putting him off throughout the episode. And finally, he's just like, it's too soon to tell, which is really brutal. Right. I mean, he's like, you know, Ari kind of loves Vince as sort of an excuse to be young. He thinks he has sort of commercial potential. But ultimately, his verdict is he's not actually sure Vince is a good actor or that he's going to become one. And, you know, just nothing in the studio builds towards that level of emotional engagement in a way that illustrates the tension between art and commerce, at least not in the two episodes I managed to put myself through.
Peter, you like it more. What do you like?
It's really nicely shot. It's really nicely acted. I think the individual scenes have like just a great crackle to them, right? The thing that Alyssa doesn't like, the tension, the anxiety, you don't get that by accident. That is actually like quite expertly designed. And the rhythm and pacing of the show, just, I mean, overall, I think like just on a moment to moment basis, the show really works very well. It does the thing that it sets out to do effectively. I think maybe even better than effectively, like artfully, and it made me laugh. Yes, it's tense and sort of like nerve wracking, especially I think in the first episode. But once I got into its rhythms and sort of saw how it was always going to like give us this schmuck bumbling his way through, you know, different parts of the movie industry, I was like, okay, this is going to be a tour of all the different things you have to do as a kind of executive decider type in the movie business and how hard it is to do even the most basic ones, like the most basic tasks, like tell Ron Howard that his movie doesn't need a 40-minute coda in which the character, like the main character, finds himself by relating to this sort of son figure who's based on a dead cousin when you've got a great 2-hour action movie that like precedes it. Like you just, that's the job of the executive. You have to say that, right? And you also have to get out of the way when the director is trying to do a long, complicated shot, even if you want to be there. And there's a way in which it's sort of ridiculous. He would know. He would have some sense that this is, in fact, the moment to step back and just shut up. And he would be less ridiculous about it. I was similarly bothered by the lack of backstory, character context, like sort of professional engagement in this world. And I think there's in some ways, a more interesting to me version of this that has our main character step into that studio role, kind of knowing what he's in for or having very specific ideas mm-hmm. about what it is that this takes, right? Like I have made movies this way. I've made over the past 22 years, I am the producer of this many films, right? And like, you talk to anybody, and I have specific ideas about what works, what doesn't, and like, this is how I made myself successful. We're going to take that and we're going to expand it, and I'm going to do more of it. And that's what I want. Someone who has that particular ambition and that sense of all the risks, you know, and pitfalls and traps that are involved. And he just doesn't have that. On the other hand, that is a show that probably appeals a little bit more to insiders. It's also probably a little bit of a darker show. It doesn't have that kind of audience surrogate, you know, sort of question built into it, like, you think this is so easy. I think that's right. I think that's why this is designed the way it is because it's meant to appeal to people who like movies, but not necessarily people who are reading trade pubs every single day. I think the other thing that bugged me about this is that as much as I, of course, enjoy a Hollywood satire, like, and get all of the stuff that they're doing. Oh, it's all these player references. And yes, I understand, like, who these characters are based on. And Seth Rogen was, you know, hit the reason that Sony's, that we have this character based on the former Sony head is at least partly because there was this hack of Sony that came out in response to Seth's North Korea film. And it's just like this whole bizarre backstory, you know, and I get all of that, right? I have read the Spider-Man should be an EDM dancing, tough mutter running, like, millennial emails, and I know about all of that stuff. The more I watch movies, and the older I get, and the more Hollywood sort of sinks into being a kind of full-on nostalgia act, the more I'm kind of bugged just by Hollywood constantly celebrating, like, literally... Yeah. Celebrating and like digging into its own history and like, yes, okay, this is not just sort of a straightforward like earnest celebration, but this is something that is predicated on like a deep nostalgia for like Hollywood should be great. Hollywood can be great. It used to run the culture. I mean, there's this whole bit in the beginning of the first episode where Rogan's talking with his assistant, who then becomes a creative producer when he moves up, about how they feel like they're in this business 30 years too late and they want to make great art, but they've got to make, you know, superhero franchises and crap IP. And I just, it's like someone a few years ago, the moment that broke me was whenever it was that the Shape of Water won Best Picture, whether it's 2019, 2018, something like that. I don't have it in my head. In any case, there was a tweet that I think it was before the Oscars. Maybe it came out afterwards, but it was like, you knew it was going to win Best Picture when you saw this band of freaks and misfits sitting around the TV watching an old movie and finding that was how they found community together. Right. And it's like, yes, that's how you know, because this is the thing that Hollywood can't get over is telling stories about itself over and over again. And it's got to find other stories to tell, like about little Tetris blocks that say chicken jockey.
But I think Alyssa's point that it's not mean enough is probably closer to the truth than it's a celebration. I do not watch the show and think, oh, this movie is, or this show is really celebrating Hollywood.
Okay, it's not celebrating exactly, but it is built on a warmth and nostalgia for what Hollywood was and ideally should still be, but maybe can't be. And it's literally just a story set on a freaking studio backlot, and it's really well done, and there are movies that I like that are set on studio backlots or about the business of Hollywood. I love The Player. It just feel like there's too much of this now built into Hollywood, this inward-looking self-regard of wanting to tell our stories about what we do, and even when we're not literally specifically telling our stories. I mean, watch the freaking The Bear. Which is a great show about, and it is interesting in the way that it takes you out of like the sort of Hollywood creative milieu and puts you in a kitchen with this young, ambitious kid. But all the problems they have are just the problems that you have running a set in a TV show. It's all the different clashing personalities, different artistic sensibilities. The guy who's like, you know, who is young and in charge and like is super difficult. Right. And then all like the cost, like it's just, everything that is a problem on The Bear is only barely a cooking problem and is mostly a problem of like, it's really hard to get people to like to do a big creative enterprise that requires them to be there and acting in concert in real time, which is literally what movies and television have to do. And even when you see TV shows and movies that are not specifically about Hollywood, there's always this sense in the background that it's like, yeah, this is actually just about Hollywood. I rewatched the RoboCop remake that was, I don't know, 8 years old, 10 years old, recently, the one with Michael Keaton as the and Gary Oldman.
Yeah, yeah. And I know.
I had not realized when I first saw this a decade ago or whatever it was, that this it's actually just a metaphor for how studio suits like screw up your artistic intentions and your technology, because the whole thing is about how like about how you have to have emotion in the products that you make. Other and the studio, the suits, they want to strip out the emotion and just make it run by computers. And that's just like destroying the artistic and technological intent of the true creators. Right. And it's just like you're going to make a RoboCop movie and it's, make a RoboCop movie about a robot cop who kills people.
Is so in this metaphor. Is in Bridgerton, is Queen Charlotte the studio head who's trying to pull off like the perfect drama of the season, and like Lady Whistledown is like Nikki Fink, and the actual like people in the Marriage Mart are the directors who can't be like told what to do? Is that are we torturing this metaphor this far? I don't think
Peter watches Bridgerton, so I don't know that makes any sense.
Everyone should watch Bridgerton. It's hilarious.
I understand your point, Peter, but you guys both picked The Brutalist as the best movie of last year. And that's just a movie about making movies. Yes, it's in architecture form, but that's just a movie about making movies.
One for me.
I get all of these complaints. I just really enjoy this manner of like vaguely mean-spirited comedy that makes everybody watching it feel like they're having a panic attack. Even as I don't entirely enjoy the sensation of watching it, and we really should emphasize that the technique here is impeccable.
Like yes, 100%.
It sets out to make your skin crawl, and it succeeds because it's shot mostly with handheld cameras, kind of like running with the cameraman moving backwards, like focused on people's faces, and it does it in a way with the soundtrack to make you constantly feel like you're on about 17 cups of coffee. And about to die.
Yeah,
I feel all the time.
I feel like our reactions to this show are much more expressions of our personalities and tastes than of any actual aesthetic judgment on the show. And I fully acknowledge that, right? Like, I think this is extremely well made and just like not my jam, not my personality, not my jam, not my taste. Like, it's the classic, like, this is just not my thing.
It's well made, and I'm going to keep watching it, but I'm still going to be annoyed that there's too many TV shows and movies about TV shows and movies happening, running at almost the exact same time as HBO is running its own thing about superhero, like a ridiculous superhero franchise called The Franchise, and about the problems of building out IP. And the, I mean, it's just, it's all there is. It's Hollywood's just like, me, 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 me.
Thumbs up or thumbs down on the studio, Alyssa?
I am not qualified. Like, I'm not qualified to issue a thumbs up or thumbs down on this. It's just like, it's if you at all have my personality and taste, thumbs down. You should not watch this for your own health.
That's a thumbs down. Peter.
Thumbs up. I'm going to keep watching this. But this is the last time I give a thumbs up to any TV show or movie that is about making TV shows or movies. Last time. Never happening again.
Until the next one. Until the next one. We watch these because we love them. Because we're suckers for this stuff. And you know it. All right. Thumbs up. Good show. Stressful show. Good show. All right. That's it for today's show. That's it for today's Across the Movie Aisle, a podcast about movies that are about TV shows about movies. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, who hopefully remembers to leave Peter Audible this week. That was a funny
hopefully
little mishap.
Does not.
Funny little mishap last week. I don't know. It seemed like a big improvement to me, but there were some complaints, whatever.
If you guys have ever seen Garfield without Garfield, Google it. It's like that would be Across the Movie Aisle without Peter.
All right. Make sure to movies with friends without friends. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.